Before we dive into today's discussion, we have a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get started with today's show.
Until the end of December, tune in to Premier Christmas Radio and experience the hope, peace, love and joy that only the sounds of Christmas can bring. Enjoy hours of Christmas music, classic carols and festive favourites. Listen now on the Premier Plus app or your smart speaker. Premier Christmas Radio, the real sound of Christmas, in association with Open Doors. Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
We've got another chunky medical ethical bioethics issue to discuss today, which is the issue of contraception. I guess we should start off by explaining why we're tackling this now. I think we've both spotted that when I was, you know, kind of growing up as a churchgoer 20, 30 years ago, there was this very clear sense that, you know, the Catholic Church has always been very opposed, but they're slightly strange. All other Christians are very relaxed about contraception and have basically the same approach as kind of wider culture. And it feels like actually in the last 10, 15 years, that has started to shift. And I increasingly come across Protestant Christians of various types, including lots of evangelicals, who are now much more open to kind of Catholicism's historic hostility. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, no, it definitely has. And I've noticed that, you know, when I quite often give talks about medical ethics, from a Christian perspective, different groups, often it's issues at the beginning of life. Time and again, this is the issue which I get asked about in the Q&A session. It's very often this particular issue, which there are clearly a lot of people, Christians, who want to live lives in accordance with fundamental Christian and biblical principles, and they really agonize about contraception, and they ask my advice. It's absolutely, I think, a live issue for many, particularly younger people who are coming across different responses. Particularly, I have to say, things coming across from America, where contraception has become lined with pro-life kind of attitudes and campaigning.
Yeah, and we'll certainly come onto this in the second half of the podcast, but yeah, as you say, to flag that up, I think a large amount of the kind of re-questioning of contraception from evangelicals and Protestants whose traditions have previously been okay about it is kind of downstream of the ethics of abortion. And, you know, if life begins at conception, where does that leave different contraceptive methods? So we'll certainly tackle that. But I think the other angle in this is that it's not just within the church that questions are being raised. It's certainly something I've noticed in the last few years, and that women in particular, non-Christian women, are starting to question the wisdom of being on the pill for their entire kind of fertile lives, as their mothers probably took for granted and didn't question. I think there's a growing sense that some of the, you know, messing around with your hormones for years upon years is potentially not a good thing for you and your body. There's a growing awareness of some of the side effects, both physical and around mental health, of being on the pill. And I think a sense that, you know, that maybe with modern technology and apps that track your period cycles, we can do contraception without interfering with our endocrine system just as effectively. Have you seen that as well?
Yes, absolutely. There's definitely a trend in that direction. And I think concerns about the side effects of long-term hormonal contraception has increased. And some people, including myself, suspect that this is actually part of the factor behind the really very significant rise in the number of abortions we're seeing in the UK, that despite the availability of very effective oral contraception, it seems that increasing numbers of young women are reluctant to use this. And obviously the whole wellness culture, the idea of taking these weird artificial hormones and being permanently taking them, it doesn't fit well with, modern ideas of wellness, does it?
No, absolutely. You know, it's of a piece, I would say, or at least it's on a continuum with some of the more extreme kind of anti-vax sentiment. You know, why should I take this artificial chemical thing produced by a big pharma company around the world? Actually, I can, you know, it's much healthier and safer and better for me to use natural methods, whatever that might be, rather than these horrible chemicals and pills and drugs. And I think, yeah, that certainly ties into a kind of backlash I'm seeing in certain parts against contraception. So it's certainly a live issue, I think, in a way it maybe wasn't a generation ago. So we thought we'd have a podcast about it. I think that before we get into all the ethics, should we do a kind of lightning quick tour about the kind of science and the history? Because humans have been trying to control whether they procreate through each act of sex for as long as they've been having sex, basically, haven't they?
No, they have. And you know, there's been an explosion in understanding of the basic biology of human fertilization and embryo development and so on, a lot of it being associated with developments with reproductive technology, IVF and other kinds of technologies. So we now know quite a lot about what happens naturally. And what we know, and one of the facts which we know, and which is sometimes quite hard to get your head around, but that a very significant number of embryos that are created naturally during the normal cycle fail to implant. And estimates vary at somewhere between 10 and 40% of the of failures of embryos to implant. And then there are subsequently spontaneous miscarriages as well, which may occur. And so it's been estimated the total loss from all the way from fertilization to birth is somewhere between 40 and 60%.
Yeah. And yet even despite that, it, you know, clearly for time immemorial, some people, often men, have been trying to avoid the possibility of having sex. And so, you know, I think we know from the historical record, kind of crude barrier methods of contraception have been going back all the way to the ancient Egyptians trying to use various things. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah, you said avoiding the possibility of having sex. What you meant was avoiding the possibility of having babies. They were very keen to have sex.
They were very keen to have sex and less keen on having the consequences of sex, which can be children. And so human beings have been trying to use, you know, particular kind of barrier forms of contraception for as long as they've been having sex, but also other forms of you know, taking herbs and drugs that were believed to interfere. I mean, we'll discuss in a moment the kind of the church's history and position on abortion, but we can see from even reading, you know, accounts from thousands of years ago, you know, where church fathers were condemning the taking of certain potions and things like that. So it wasn't just simply barrier methods, but people have been trying various different things to achieve contraception for a very long time.
Yes, and historically, there was always an association between contraception and abortion and herbs which were abortifacients that actually induced abortion. And in particular, also, these kind of drugs were often associated with prostitution, and therefore there was the whole area of birth control was felt to be not really something which normal people should talk about. It was a kind of inappropriate, a dark area of human activity. And this was not just coming from the Christian church. I think it was just respectable society didn't really talk about these matters. They were inappropriate for normal, decent people.
Yeah. And then I think it's really in the last kind of 200, 150 years that humans start to get a bit more sophisticated about their birth control. And, you know, Victorians had kind of rudimentary condoms and things like that. And then it really kicks off in the 20th century, doesn't it, when we understand the endocrine system a bit better and hormones. And do you want to explain a little bit about the kind of development of hormonal contraception?
Yes, and a key figure in all this is Margaret Sanger, who was a very early feminist in the early 20th century, and who was passionately concerned about birth control. And she founded the American Birth Control and opened the first birth control clinic in America. And this is 1916. And she apparently came under a great deal of hostility. And it seems that her motivation was primarily humanitarian. And she was very concerned about the fact that so often that women had no control over contraception, that men often impregnated their wives and other women, forcing them to have many pregnancies, and that therefore a principal battle was to give education. And so she was one of the pioneers in helping to inform women about the mechanics of reproduction and how to control their own fertility.
Hmm. And then as we get into the second half of the century, she's actually again involved in the process of developing the first hormonal contraception, isn't she?
Yeah, and it's an interesting story, which I outline briefly in my book, Transforming Friendship, as it kind of it's part of the story of the transformation and attitudes towards sex. But apparently in the 1950s, she asked a reproductive scientist to undertake research into the possibility of creating a birth control pill. And at that time, clinicians were testing the effects of giving hormones such as progesterone to female patients. And she was funded by a wealthy heiress, and they undertook clinical trials in a poor community in Puerto Rico, because on mainland USO, contraception was seen as illegal, and therefore it wasn't possible to do research. But the trials which they did in Puerto Rico showed that giving hormones with progesterone hormones was remarkably effective in preventing pregnancy. And then in 1957, apparently, the FDA, the US Drug Regulatory Authority, approved the use of the first oral pill. But it was described as the aim of the pill was to regulate menstruation, although the package insert warned that the medication had a contraceptive side effect.
So this is all a bit kind of nod, wink, wink. You know, this is for, you know, air quotes, regulating menstruation, when really the women buying it know full well they're buying this product to avoid getting pregnant.
That's right. And within 2 years, 500,000 women were ostensibly using this medication to, quote, keep their periods regular. and in the following year, the FDA approved a pill which was explicitly for use as an oral contraception. And then it just, you know, it had an extraordinary impact. 5 years later, one in four of every married woman in America is using the pill. Mm. And it then takes off and spreads across the world.
And this is the kind of, the watershed moment, isn't it? When, you know, for thousands, tens of thousands of years, humans have been sporadically messing around with various methods to try and control fertility, to try and prevent conception. And then suddenly there is this product which a woman, completely out of the control of the man, can take off her own volition, that is highly, if taken properly, highly effective, 99%+ effective at preventing pregnancy. And this completely revolutionizes how men and women have sex forevermore.
And it's seen as a breakthrough moment for feminism, isn't it? Because for the first time, women are now completely in control, quotes, of their own reproductive potential. It's invisible. You can't tell whether a woman is taking the pill, and it's seen as liberatory. It now allows her to behave like a man. She can enter the reproductive field knowing that she's in control.
Mm. And yet, if you think about what Margaret Sanger was motivated by, primarily it seems it's not about liberating women to have more sexual partners without the risk of pregnancy. She's really driven by the fact that as she sees it, women having endless pregnancies within, you know, long-term relationships, marriages, is bad for women because it is bad for their health. It keeps them chained to the home for long periods of time. It prevents them from entering the workplace and prevents them from getting education. So she's not really trying to kind of create the permissive, promiscuous society that the pill generates. She's actually motivated by trying to liberate women from the kind of drudgery and the imprisonment of endless child rearing.
Now, that's undoubtedly true. And there's no doubt at all that she was genuinely motivated by humanitarian concern for many women, particularly in very poor communities, poor socioeconomic circumstances and so on. It has to be said, though, that Sanger, like many other people in that period, also had really quite openly eugenic concerns. It's a concern which is expressed so many times. I've heard it in many different forms over the years. But it's basically the idea that the wrong kind of people are having far too many babies, whilst the right kind of people are not having enough babies. And if we allow this situation to carry on, within time, the entire population will be deviated, will be shifted, and we'll have far more of the wrong type of babies and far fewer of the right type of babies.
Hmm. So was she, do you think, implicitly or even explicitly hoping that the pill would lower the fertility rates of the kind of teeming mass of the working classes so that they didn't kind of swamp the refined elites who were only having two children as opposed to five?
Well, I think it was a very real and genuine concern about the future of society, you know, and I mean, don't forget that the breeding of animals is completely routine. You know, so many people were all holding farmers and so on. And of course you knew that you would pair the good cows or the good sheep. And it would be madness to allow all the really, you know, genetically problematic sheep to take over your flock. And people just applied the same commonsensical approach to human, you know, the balances of society. Of course, interesting, isn't it? Now, looking back 100 years later, this sounds horrific. And of course, this is because we know much more now about where that kind of eugenic thinking can lead. And the horrors of the later 20th century.
Yeah. So that's kind of our whistle-stop tour of contraception. And, you know, as you say, from the 1960s, the pill spreads around the world. There are different, you know, methods of kind of getting the hormones into women's bodies. You can now have it as an implant, under your skin, a coil, various other things. But basically, you know, for the last half century, for the first time in human history, most women, certainly around the world, can, if they wish to, at relatively low cost, almost entirely prevent pregnancy while still remaining sexually active, which is a kind of unprecedented ethical situation for Christians to be trying to respond to.
And it should just be worth just as a quick detour about how the pill works. And there are basically three ways in which an oral contraceptive pill or a hormonal contraceptive works. The primary way in which all these hormones work is by inhibiting ovulation, by suppressing the monthly production of the egg. And in fact, what many of them do is that they induce a hormonal state which normally occurs during pregnancy. So they put the woman into the state of as though she is pregnant from a hormonal point of view. That switches off ovulation, but it also has other effects. It changes the nature of the cervical mucus, making it more difficult for the sperm to pass in to the womb if intercourse has taken place. And thirdly, it has an effect on the uterine lining, which makes it less likely that if an embryo occurred and appeared in the womb, it's less likely that it would actually implant on the lining of the womb.
Okay, so in kind of crude layman's terms, it stops eggs from being created. It makes it harder for sperm to reach them if they do get created. And even if the sperm and egg do manage to, despite all the odds, fertilize, it then makes it much more, like, less likely for that fertilized egg to implant and start to grow into an embryo.
Yes, but the important point, I think, which is interesting and is very relevant, is that the amount of very detailed, high-quality research that has been undertaken on the mechanism of action of contraceptives is actually quite limited. The manufacturers, their main concerns is one, is it safe? And two, does it prevent pregnancy? And once you've demonstrated that it does, the precise mechanisms by which pregnancy is presented and the requirement to do extremely expensive and difficult scientific studies in order to work out which of those three different mechanisms is the primary mechanism and how often breakthrough ovulation occurs and so on, there has been surprisingly little very high quality scientific research into those questions.
Which will be relevant when we discuss some of the concerns that Christians have about contraception. So let's talk, that's kind of contraception, a biological and social history in 15 minutes. Let's move on to then how has the church thought about contraception? And what it might surprise some people listening to this is actually for 90%+ of the church's existence, there's been almost a unanimous view, which is very, very hostile, isn't it, to contraception?
Yes, indeed. Because of the association with, as we said earlier, its association with abortion, its association with prostitution, with promiscuity, and with the church, Christians really, for ever since the early Christian centuries, have regarded this as something that was inappropriate for Christians and to be avoided.
I was looking back at some quotes. You know, lots of the church fathers address this as a famous line in Augustine, where he is talking about married couples who are having sex not for the purpose of procreation. Though they be called husband and wife, they are not, nor do they retain any reality of marriage, but they use the respectable name of marriage to cover a shame. Sometimes this lustful cruelty or cruel lust comes to this, that they even use sterilizing drugs. So there's a sense that the point of sex is about having children, and anything that interferes with that is deeply, deeply contrary to God's will. And this idea is then kind of reaffirmed in the medieval era by the famous theologian Thomas Aquinas, who picks up on Augustine and Jerome and some of the other church fathers and says, you know, makes the case again that, you know, God's natural order of things is that every time you have sex, it should be open to the possibility of conception. And therefore, any artificial means of interfering with that is sinful.
Yes, and it's interesting, isn't it, that it's not really until the 20th century and the starting of concern and interest in, as I said, Margaret Sanger and others, that about the negative effects of having very large numbers of children, and also a more positive understanding of sexual activity. That Christians could, instead of seeing sex entirely for the purpose of procreation, might start to see it as something having some other benefits, and particularly within the life of a married couple.
Yeah. The other just quick thing before we get to the change in the 20th century is that it was often associated with the sin of onanism, which is goes back to a story of someone called Onan in the Old Testament, who practiced coitus interruptus, or the withdrawal method, as some people might know it, and he was kind of condemned by God for basically sleeping with someone, I can't remember exactly who, and then pulling out before ejaculation to ensure that he didn't impregnate her.
It is, you're right, it's coitus interruptus, it therefore was applied to all masturbation. By definition, yeah, masturbation,
spilling your seed on the
spilling
ground,
your seed, was regarded as inappropriate.
Onan's his older brother had been killed by God, in fact, and so his duty was to, therefore, as brother-in-law, was to marry his sister-in-law in what's sometimes called a levirate marriage, and this was kind of laid out in God's law that, you know, if your brother dies, you should marry, not leave your sister-in-law a widow, but marry her yourself. and to ensure that she has children to continue the kind of brother's name in his stead. And Onan was not a fan of this because it meant that if he, you know, married Tamar, his brother's widow, and had children with her, they would then inherit. Whereas if she remains childless, he would then inherit. So he tries to kind of square the circle by marrying her. But whenever he has sex with Tamar, he withdrew before he ejaculated, spilling his seed on the ground, as the Bible text says, and therefore prevented any children from being born that would kind of steal his inheritance. And the Bible says that this so displeased the Lord that the Lord also slew him as he lay on the ground.
So it's pretty clear in that context that the reason that Onan is judged so severely is because of his disobedience to God's will. It's, and the spilling of the seed on the ground is really not the main point.
Not the point, yes.
And yet this one reference to masturbation in the entire biblical narrative is then taken to imply that anything that involves spilling seed on the ground is directly contrary to God's wishes.
We're excited to announce the launch of a brand new podcast from Premier Insight called The Bible Explored with Rico Tice, featuring Rico Tice, a renowned British preacher and apologist. The Bible Explored with Rico Tice offers practical guidance for living out the eternal truth of God's word in everyday life. It will inspire and equip you to boldly share the gospel, even in life's toughest situations. To continue creating content and resources like this, we rely on the generosity of listeners like you. Your support is vital to keep Premier Insight strong and ensure programs like The Bible Explored with Rico Tice can reach more people to equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this only starts to change about 100 years ago in the 1920s and 30s. And there's a big turning point in 1930 itself when there's a meeting of the Lambeth Conference, which is a gathering of all the Anglican bishops from around the world. Happens once every 10 years or so. And in 1930, they had a big discussion about contraception, and they ended up for the first time kind of changing the church's teaching on this. And they said, in some cases where there is a clearly felt moral obligation to limit or avoid parenthood, and there is a morally sound reason for avoiding abstinence, we agree that other methods may be used, provided that this is done in the light of Christian principles. And so this is the first time kind of opening the door just a little chink to saying, actually, some Christians think that some forms of modern contraception might be permissible within a married couple, within certain circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. But it's actually seen at the time as a really, really significant change in the Christian ethics.
Yes, and I understand it created quite a lot of controversy, and in particular the Roman Catholic Church then responded by reiterating their view that all forms of deliberate contraception were inappropriate.
That's right. It was such a big deal that the Pope actually issued a kind of official papal letter in response to what the Anglicans were saying, rejecting it, and kind of re-established the church teaching of the Catholic Church, which is that the procreative nature of sex is primary. But this is interesting. Is actually, for the first time, it's when the church teaches that there is also a secondary kind of unitive aspect to sex. So sex is not just about procreation. So there's a famous line where it says, "Nor are those considered as acting against nature who, in the married state, use their right in the proper manner, although on account of natural reasons, either of time or of certain defects, new life cannot be brought forth," which is a real mouthful. But what he's basically saying is, it's not sinful to have sex, even if you know, whether through infertility or through age, i.e. menopause, that no children will result. So it's the first time the Catholics are saying, procreation is central, but we recognize that there is a secondary good of sex, which is the unitive aspect of it. And you don't have to always be procreating for sex to be good. But what they say, what we cannot accept is any attempt to artificially cut off the procreative thing through the use of contraception.
And running behind this is this fundamental Catholic understanding of natural theology, which is understanding the intention, the purpose that lies behind the sexual act. And they would say that the natural purpose of the sexual act is to bring forth a child, and that any deliberate attempt to frustrate that natural purpose is illicit, because it is frustrating God's purposes, which he has laid down within the creation. This kind of thinking of a natural theology of understanding the purposes, God's purposes, by understanding how nature has been constructed, how it is ordered, is the central thrust behind that form of thinking.
Absolutely. The core idea, as you say, is that human beings only flourish when they kind of live within the tram lines that God has already established, that, you know, we, as maybe as Protestants might say, and those tram lines are set out in Scripture. And Catholics would say, yes, and they're also set out just by observing how the world works. And if we live within the, go with the grain of creation, that is how we flourish. And in particular, when it comes to sex, the Catholic Church actually says, you know, that sex is a co-creation. You know, the husband and the wife create the physical matter, and then God creates the eternal soul to put into this new person. And they have this kind of almost sacramental sense that procreation is not something human beings are doing on their own volition, but you are collaborating in this sacred procreative act with God himself. And so therefore, to take it upon yourself to frustrate the divine will by using contraception is seen as not just a kind of ethical no-no, but like almost like a mortal sin.
Yes. And so their belief is that every time there is a sexual act, an act of intercourse, it must be open to the possibility of a child being born, at least if that is humanly possible. Yeah. And hence, both a barrier method, which prevents the sperm from reaching the egg, or a hormonal method, is inappropriate. But interestingly, Catholics do strongly support is what is often called the rhythm method, which is understanding the monthly cycle and avoiding intercourse at the times when ovulation might occur and therefore an embryo and a child might be formed. But it's perfectly okay to concentrate intercourse in the other periods.
So this actually, interestingly, has been kind of officially ratified or affirmed by Catholic teaching as far back as the 1850s is the first time it comes up. And so even, you know, when in the 1930s, the Anglicans are starting to open the door to contraception and the Catholics are slamming it shut again, this is in the context of where multiple generations of Catholics have been told that it's fine to use the rhythm method. But by the 1960s, so another generation later, the pill is now widespread, and it kind of forces Catholicism to think again. And so in 1963, the Pope actually established a commission of theologians and experts to kind of explore the issue. And 3 years later, they reported back that the use of contraceptives should be regarded as an extension of the already accepted cycle method, noting that the rhythm method already separated out, quote, the sexual act, which is explicitly intended, and its reproductive effect, which is intentionally excluded. So they basically said, look, if the Catholic Church is okay with the rhythm method, we should make our peace with other forms of contraception. But fascinatingly, the Pope, which had actually changed in the 3 years since this commission was set up, the previous Pope had died, the new Pope said, nope, and just flat out rejected what the commission's thought and issued his own statement, a famous encyclical called Humanae Vitae, which reaffirmed its opposition to contraception, but very explicitly said, the rhythm method is fine because the rhythm method alone of all forms of contraception works within the tram lines of natural order. It works within the way that God has created human beings and women's bodies to work, which is that, you know, approximately 3 weeks in four, apart from the few days before and after ovulation, you know, sex cannot lead to conception.
And this led to the clever quip, I don't know who first said it, was that when it comes to preventing children being conceived, Catholics are not allowed to use either the science of physics or the science of chemistry, but they are allowed to use the science of mathematics.
Yeah, and when you reduce it to that, I can certainly see that it starts to become a bit absurd. And you could say the kind of the sensible, coherent moral positions are all contraception is fine or all contraception is bad. But to try and differentiate between barrier contraception and hormonal contraception is bad, but rhythm-based counting your cycle is good, does seem, on the surface of it, potentially a difficult distinction to draw in, with any kind of philosophical coherence.
Well, and in particular, I have been very influenced by this understanding of Christian ethics, which puts a great focus on the intention. I mean, in biblical terms, it's what is the heart. It's what God sees the heart. God sees our deepest intentions. And it's so often it's our intentions which provide a very helpful way of analysing our moral actions. So in all kinds of medical ethics, the question I always want to ask is, what are we intending to achieve here? What is our goal? And is that a morally acceptable intention? And if the intention behind all forms of contraception is to prevent a child coming to existence, then we have to decide, is that intention, under some circumstances, a good intention? Or is it always wrong? If it's always wrong, then however we want to achieve that, whether by mathematics, physics, or chemistry, it's wrong and we shouldn't do it.
Hmm. I guess the counter argument to that would be that it's not simply about intention, but God is also interested in how you do things. And there's a distinction between using science to frustrate God's clearly established intention, which is that women are fertile every month from, you know, puberty to menopause. Whereas the point is that it is within the way that the creator has established menstruation and reproduction to work within Homo sapiens as a species, women aren't perpetually fertile. It's not the case that, you know, you can get pregnant every single time you have sex. It's impossible if it's not around ovulation. And so I guess Catholics Christians who believe in the rhythm method would say that our intention is not to frustrate the creator's design and order. Our intention is to work within the tram lines of created order. This is, God has baked this into the system as a gift for us so that we can have sex not always worry about having a child. And so we're simply taking advantage of what God has created for us.
Yes, and I can see some force in that argument. And certainly I think of other people I've spoken to who strongly commend the rhythm method for newly married couples, not least because it forces both man and woman to be much more aware of the monthly cycle, to have respect for the uniqueness of human biology. And whereas there is a kind of laissez-faire attitude towards the contraceptive pill, we just don't need to think about these things. Mm. We just do whatever we like. And so I have heard it said that the sort of side effects of focusing together as a couple on understanding natural fertility, understanding the monthly cycle, can actually have some very positive effects.
And I think there's another angle to this, which we've talked about in other podcasts, about the idea of the kind of arrogance of humans believing that we can use our superior technological knowledge to kind of master how, you know, creation works. You know, whether that's about freezing your eggs so that you can get pregnant later on or whatever else, you could argue that, you know, using hormonal contraception is effectively saying, you know, I know better and I'm going to exploit my power as a human being to control and twist and manipulate how the human body works. Whereas there is a humility about the rhythm method, which says, I'm going to try and live within the warp and weft of how the human body works and has always worked long before we even knew there was a thing called progesterone. And rather than, you know, there's almost a strange consonance with what we talked about at the start, you know, about women, the kind of wellness culture turning away from messing around with your hormones and saying, actually, perhaps what is better for us is to like let be and to receive the way our bodies work as a gift, even if it is slightly frustrating to us that they are, you know, that they women can conceive 1 week in four. Let's rather than seeking to use our technological power to master that and overcome that, let's work within that.
Yeah, no, I think there is definitely something there about, you know, these deeper implications about, there's no doubt that technology is concerned with mastery of nature. Non-human nature, mastering the environment, the context, and so on, but also mastering our own bodies. And you could say that this contraceptive attitude is just all of a piece of this modern attitude of an overwhelming desire to control, to impose my will on our own bodies. And it's a complex issue. And I think you're right, a deeper humility before the nature of our humanity, and a deeper sensitivity to one another. I mean, it basically reinforces to me that it's very important that couples talk about this before they get married and start having regular sexual intercourse, and together to come to a combined agreement as to how they're going to explore the whole business. I mean, just stepping back again, I think that the Protestant view has tended to be that there are these two aspects of marriage. There is the unitive aspect when the man and the wife come together, which is expressed in sex, but of course is much broader than the sex. It's the fact that we have become one flesh. We are living together as one flesh. And then there is the procreative aspect, and that what has often been said is that whereas in the Catholic view, the unitive and the procreative should be expressed in every single act, in the Protestant view, the unitive and the procreative still belong together, but they belong together in the entire marriage. It doesn't mean that in every single act of the couple, they are expressing both.
Hmm. And so do you think, even the average Protestant would say, if a couple get married and just decide we're going to be on contraception forever until menopause, and we are going to deliberately never, ever, ever open ourselves up to having children ever, do you think that most Protestants would say, hang on, that's actually not right? It's okay for individual seasons or times or acts of sex to be closed to procreation. But if you say we are never, as a married couple, ever going to be open to having children, that would be wrong.
Well, I would immediately want to ask the question, well, why? What is your reason for saying that? You know, it may be that for whatever reason, there are health concerns, you know, there are genetic problems, there are particular effects, you know, from the past. But if the reason is, well, you know what, I just don't particularly like children, and I don't think I'd be a very good dad, and I'd much prefer to just be able to live our own life. We love one another dearly. We just, neither of us particularly fussed by children. That kind of attitude is the attitude that I would be really concerned about, because ultimately that is selfishness. That is saying, you know, look after number one, or look after to us together. And it is possible for married couples to live lives of enormous self-centeredness. And from a Christian point of view, marriage is about giving. It's about giving to the other, but it's about giving in a wider way, and giving, having children is part of the expression of the givingness of marriage.
Yeah, I think I broadly agree. I think I just think it's important for us to broaden our horizons about what it means to serve and to give and to be other-centered. And having children is obviously a fundamental and a primary way in which that is expressed, but it's not the only way. And so, as you say, I could probably make my peace with a married couple who said, we don't want to have biological children, but we are going to, you know, procreate and serve and give and be outward focused through our church family, and we're going to, you know, effectively act as kind of surrogate parents to a whole heap of people we might know, and support single mums and, you know, foster care and this kind of stuff. And I think there's more than one way to procreate. And while the kind of standard biological way is the inevitable and primary and obvious one for 90%+ of couples, I think you're right. My objection would not be, how dare you not kind of maintain your seed and you know, all that stuff. It would be more about, actually, it's profoundly unhealthy for a marriage to not be outward focused, for a marriage not seek to overflow. This love between husband and wife should overflow in creativity and in spilling out into other people's lives, but it doesn't necessarily have to always happen through biological procreation.
No, I agree. And I think, again, it comes back to intention, isn't it? What's in your heart? What's your motivation? What lies behind these decisions that you're taking? And you know, that there's this wonderful expression in the Old Testament, above all, guard your heart, because it is the wellspring of life. And selfishness, to have a selfish heart, to say in the end we're looking after number one, runs very antithetical to this Christian understanding of how we are called to become the people that God made us to be.
Shall we move on quickly to another tricky question, ethical question around contraception, which I think you've been, you know, directly approached by some Christian couples, which is their concern is not necessarily about the procreative unitive side of it, but is that if they believe as evangelical Christians that life begins at conception, does it mean that by taking the pill or other forms of hormonal contraception, you are running the risk of effectively aborting a fertilized egg that is unable to be implanted?
Yes, this is a challenging and difficult topic, but I have been approached by a whole number of Christians along these lines. And as far as I can see, it goes back, particularly the issue is raised by an American pastor called Randy Alcorn, who wrote a book called Does the Birth Control Pill Cause Abortions? About 15, 20 years ago. And his argument is basically that since we believe that there is a person, that there is a living being present from the point of fertilization, if from time to time the abortion pill causes an embryo to fail to implant, then that is abortion. And we should, even if it only occurs on a few percent of times, it would be completely wrong for Christians to take the pill, because they are threatening the life of an unborn child. And therefore, his conclusion was it was completely wrong for Christians ever to use the contraceptive pill, not because of the concerns about contraception, but because effectively it was causing abortion. Mm.
Do you share those concerns?
Well, it's it takes us into this very complex and murky area of trying to understand the nature of the human embryo. And this is something we have talked about before, Tim. But what I find is that there's a very strong desire by many people to either conclude the embryo is a little baby. It's just a very tiny baby, so tiny that we can hardly see. It's an unborn baby, or else it's just a bundle of cells. And you've basically got to choose one or the other. And many Christians say, well, it's pretty obvious that it's an unborn baby. It's just a very tiny baby. And therefore, I have to treat it in every way as a tiny baby. My own view is that is just... It's too simplistic, and in fact that the embryo is a strange kind of being that is, to use a flashy term, sui generis. It is neither just a bundle of cells nor it is an unborn baby, but it's we have to have a new category of thought. It's a human in the earliest microscopic stage of the journey, an embryotic human, which is different in kind from anything else in our experience. And one of the really fascinating things is that when a woman it has intercourse, an embryo is formed. The embryo is formed in the fallopian tube. While it is in the fallopian tube, the woman is completely unaware of its existence. Everyone is unaware of its existence. It's, if you like, below the radar screen. It's not possible to know whether that little embryo is there. It's only after implantation, when all of a sudden things start changing in the woman's body, and signs of pregnancy start to emerge, the tests go positive, and now it's possible to know that that embryo is there and has been implanted. So in the previous period, what happens to that embryo is beneath the radar screen. In fact, we know, as you said earlier on, that possibly 30% or more of those embryos that are formed in the fallopian tube fail to implant, and they're just passed in the menstrual period, and the woman never knows that she that an embryo was there. And I feel that's part of God's creation order, that the embryo at that stage is below the radar screen. Once implantation has occurred, then the woman is aware of it. And so my conclusion is that, you know, whether we know it or not, any couple who are having regular intercourse, they will be, the fact of having intercourse is leading to the death of unimplanted embryos. And if you're going to say they are like little children and you're causing little children to die, surely you would then say, well, then it's much better not to have intercourse at all, because you would be causing the risk of the death of an unborn baby. And therefore, I think that that's not the case. Christians have always encouraged and recommended married couples to continue to have intercourse. In fact, the Apostle Paul effectively says that, doesn't he? And therefore,
and that's even the case for couples in the rare circumstances who have a biological issue which causes kind of repeated miscarriages. You know, the standard Christian ethical approach is not to say, oh, for goodness sake, stop trying to have a child in case it miscarries. You know, this might be, you know, 12, 18, 25 weeks when no one denies that there is a child inside the mother's womb. This is, no one says, well, the parents are morally culpable for the death of that child.
And so we come back to our old friend intention. You know, why are the people with recurrent miscarriage not morally culpable by continuing to try and have a child? Answer: because their intention is not to destroy the life of a child. Their intention is to bring a baby into the world, but they foresee the possibility that a baby, an unborn baby, might be formed that then subsequently miscarries.
And so would you say that even if we accept that there is a slight possibility that taking the pill might on rare occasions cause a fertilized egg to fail to implant and be lost, that is a kind of version of the kind of ethical principle of double effect. It's a foreseeable consequence, but not your intention, and so therefore not like immoral on those grounds.
I think that's right. And of course, you know, if you're really well biologically well informed, you would also work out that if you'd just had intercourse, a woman and just had intercourse, and then decided to go skiing, and that involves air flight and it involves, you know, all the things happening in the skiing, there's also a small chance that they might unintentionally cause an embryo to fail to implant, but it's not their intention.
Yeah, I think that's a helpful way of stepping back a bit, because I think if you start, as a lot of Christians, I think, have start from a pro-life position, believe that that means that they must believe, so they're anti-abortion, they then say, well, that must mean that life begins at conception. That must mean that every time the sperm and egg touch, a human being with exactly the same rights, dignities and protections that you or I have has been created. And therefore, anything that causes that being to die is equivalent to, morally equivalent to murder, end up in a quite tricky position. But it's actually, it's helpful to step back and say, actually, lots of points in that chain of reasoning are actually a bit reductive, a bit simplistic, and don't actually acknowledge the complexity and the mystery in what we're talking about. There's even with our knowledge of human menstruation cycles and hormones and stuff. There is still so much mystery here, isn't there?
Yeah, and so just to earth it on my own, you know, having agonized with these things over many years, I think my conclusion is still we shouldn't intend to intentionally destroy an embryo. If embryos have been created, for instance, in the laboratory, I don't believe in general it's right, for instance, to do destructive research to intentionally destroy these beings. But I do recognise that all the complexities and the things that are going on, which we can never really control, as long as our intention is not to destroy human life, we can recognise that from time to time, unintentionally, embryonic human beings will be destroyed. And this is a mysterious part of the creation and particularly of a fallen and broken creation. We've done elsewhere, haven't we, podcasts about the broken nature of creation, about genetic abnormalities and so on. And this is very much related to that. And many of those embryos that fail to implant turn out to have very major genetic abnormalities, which are incompatible with life. And why they're formed, it remains mysterious. But I think from a theological point of view, we can see it as part of this bigger pattern of a broken a creation which still has the God's good creation order within it, but which has been damaged and malformed and warped by the effects of evil.
And you know, this reminds me of what you talked about at the start about Margaret Sanger and her kind of humanitarian concern. It wasn't just that women weren't able to be in the workplace or get educated, but it's also that she saw that endlessly being pregnant or having a series of miscarriages is quite destructive. It can be quite destructive to women. And that, you know, as any woman will know, and it's something I appreciate secondhand, is that the way humans reproduce, while wonderful and beautiful and life-giving, is also quite, you know, broken and flawed. And, you know, women's bodies are put through the ringer month after month, even though, as you say, lots of those eggs aren't going to ever grow up into human beings, and yet their ovaries release an egg and surge in hormones. It produces all these complicated side effects, and that's before you start messing around with artificial hormone, you know, through the pill. It's just, it feels like the whole system is laboring under the curse that you read about in Genesis. It's not just childbirth itself, but the whole reproductive system is in some sense cursed and broken and laborious and difficult and painful for women to endure, and yet also is the crucible in which this incredible gift of new life comes from.
Yeah, and I think it's good perhaps to end here. And you know, it's easy for us as two blokes to go on about, you know, and I can hear a lot of women say, what do you know? And you know, we put up our hands, but I think we want to recognise that there is a great deal of brokenness, there is sadness. It's quite likely that many people listening to this podcast have had painful issues of miscarriage, of prolonged infertility,
traumatic pregnancies and labor experiences, emergency cesareans,
failed attempts to have reproductive technology, and so on. So I think recognizing the pain, being charitable to one another, there's also, in the end, I'm responsible for the light I've been given and to try and live in response to the light. And I recognize that other Christians come to different conclusions, and together we encourage one another, we listen to one another, we respect one another, we try to learn more and to grow in Christlikeness and in faithfulness, whilst recognizing that actually these are going to be deep, divisive issues within the Christian community.
Yeah, and I think it is vital, as you say, to hold these things lightly. We're all grasping around with incomplete knowledge. You know, the Bible isn't crystal clear on these questions. A lot is mysterious, and I think a lot of Christians in good faith can come to different conclusions. And it's important, I think, particularly as men as well, not to kind of be issuing stentorian dictums and you know, throwing around words like mortal sin and this kind of stuff, when these are deeply felt issues that couples, and a lot of it does fall on women's shoulders, are having to wrestle with day in, day out. So yeah, I hope that was a helpful conversation to kind of tease out some of the questions that people are asking around contraception. We'd love to know your own thoughts as well, if you have any disagreements or other angles that we haven't discussed, or just your own comments on what we've been talking about, do get in touch. We love to hear from listeners. And especially if you have any suggestions for things that we could discuss in future podcasts, you can reach us by emailing MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. You can find Dad's website, which has got a smorgasbord of resources, talks, Bible studies, books, videos, podcasts, a lot of it about medical ethics, start of life, end of life. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find out more about some of my church journalism at tswyatt.com. But thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.